This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. My name's David Wilk, and I'm interviewing today E.M. Broner, the author of The Red Squad, a novel. Hello, Esther. How are you?
I'm well, David. How are you?
Good. Thanks for talking to me today. I read Red Squad, and I enjoyed it a great deal. I found it to be, partially because it relates to a period of time that I'm very familiar with personally. Maybe you could talk a little bit about it, because I think for readers who may not know about this book and may not know about the period, it goes back and forth between the 60s and the present.
Yes.
And a period in the 60s when politics were very different than they are today. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the structure of the book.
I don't know if politics are so different, David. At one point, someone asks if the 1960s was a precursor to what's happening today. So, a prequel. So, I think an activist maybe always has the same kind of life, but it was a group of young instructors who all had offices in a bullpen. And the one of them becomes very active and against the war, and the others join in. And from that comes a knowledge of the war culture, a knowledge of what's happening in Detroit with Motown. At the same time, there's terrible war culture. There's also this wonderful music. And all these young instructors are passionate and interested in everything. So it's what happened in the 60s, the dress, the dancing, the drinking. And then 40 years later, it begins again when the main character, Anka, gets a file on her, an envelope on her porch, and sort of rips it open and realizes it's really been ripped from her own life. And it's her FOIA, her Freedom of Information file, telling about her activities during the 60s with specific names for the cases. She's given numbers, and it's all the terrorism squad, it's all the investigative squad, and it's called the Red Squad of, and it turns out that this squad was all over the country, operated by the police department. And she looks at the comments, and first, as an English professor, she's very annoyed because the grammar is bad of the spy. She can't bear a bad grammatical spy. But when she sees that not only does it involve her, but everybody that she was connected with, the people who showed up at a peace rally, the people on a panel, everybody's listed there. And then she is, the information is at the end, she is told, this must be private. You are not allowed to tell anyone. And so she decides very early on that she's going to let everyone know what happened and that they were all under surveillance. So when she comes, so she is this young, passionate young woman, and then there's a leap of several decades, and she's still active. She's active against the Iraq War, and she joins with a women's brigade that are all elderly activists. And I think she realizes at the end that she will never not be an activist, but that there's a great resemblance in the language between what happened in the 60s and the federal or army language and what happened after 2001. And she could get discouraged. She could have a flattened heart, but she sees these women who have been picketing since the Korean War, and she knows that she can't lose energy or hope. And it's also a love story of a person who's unavailable, one of her office mates, is leaving the church, a priest, and he's doing it carefully, the way the church then asked, and so he can't, but she has these longings, and you know, some of her dreams come true. The other thing that was teaching is a very exciting and innovative thing. And if you have a class which does not have formal instruction and formal structure, one has to think of other ways to get them interested in reading and writing, and that's what she does.
Yeah, I was really interested in the that part of the book. You have her, you know, your main character, Anka, is one of this group of teachers, but she is particularly involved with the community in Detroit. And of course, there are all these people that she ends up teaching who we later find out, you know, it comes 40 years later, what has happened to them, and they become very important to the story. So I thought there you were kind of giving us a view of teaching that is very important, that you plant these seeds with people who are then young, and if you do a good job, or if you're lucky, they go on and do something really interesting.
Well, some colleges have a labor-sponsored weekend college, and they're eager for their membership to become better informed, and they pay for their tuition. So there are several colleges that do that. So you get a particular kind of a self-selecting person who may be on the line, may be working in the boiler room, and then washes up and comes exhausted but still bravely appears. And when they can be reached, when their hearts can be reached, and when what's the medicine of grammar, that sort of thing, can be made palatable, wonderful things happen, because everybody has a story, and nobody has conferred upon them the honor of being people who have stories, and so she asks for their stories.
Right, and she actually is, you know, the one of the links between the past and the present, I think, is the idea that culture is available to anyone, and that anyone's culture is valuable, is something that you really embrace and demonstrate in this book.
Yes.
And, you know, that it's sort of the anti-hierarchical view of
absolutely
art and culture.
Yes.
And I think, you know, that is still playing out. I think we see that almost on a daily basis. This, you know, more less true perhaps than it was in the 50s, where the idea was we received culture from people who taught it to us. Now,
right,
there's much more openness to the idea of self-generating culture.
That's great.
But I think that this book kind of demonstrates that in a really evocative way.
Thank you.
And I there are differences in the way that the culture operated in the 60s, but I think you're right that you show that it's still with us, that those arguments over values and the nature, of course, of people within a regimented culture,
yes,
is still going on, never stops.
What's interesting about the 60s is the students led the faculty in the anti-war movement. The faculty didn't jump to it first. The students became involved first and told the faculty. So it made a much more democratic teaching order possible. If your students know more than you do and have and are more informed and have great ethical, moral problems, you, as the professor, cannot be separated from that.
Well, and your characters, who are kind of in between, because they're junior faculty, they're not tenured, so they could more readily see the culture change as something that they could participate in, I think.
Right, right.
But of course, it had impact on their lives, and in a lot of ways, I think you have a great cross section in that, you know, in the group there, that you know, and it doesn't always work out as you think it will work out who the people are and what they will do. And, you know, I don't want to spoil anything for anyone who hasn't read the book, so I won't give away some of the ending, which I think, you know, may be surprising in terms of what role someone played in the 60s as opposed to what role they really played or played out as their lives went on. But it, you definitely had some twists, shall we say.
Oh, that's good.
But so do you see yourself, I know you've written both fiction and nonfiction. How do you see yourself when, you know, when you're writing fiction, how is it different for you than when you're writing more expository work as you've done in your nonfiction books?
Well, my nonfiction work is often religious and or has a kind of spiritual theme, and or it has a literary, you know, sort of work which we document, like mothers and the tradition, the lost tradition, mothers and daughters in literature. I don't make up characters for that. Where I'm a main character is where I'm mourning for my father for 11 months in an atmosphere that does not want me there. It's very hostile to my doing this. And so I become a character reacting to all these strange people around me and gradually making a kind of community of them, even though there's a lot of rage and craziness. But I, the main character, go through the months of mourning, and I just thought it was a very interesting thing on the process of mourning. In actuality, the daily grind of it. I mean, you're there every morning for seven days for actually 11 months. And what happened to you in memory? So in that one, I was a character. In another one that I wrote, I think first person, it's really short stories called Ghost Stories. The main character is talking to her mother, who has also died. And through the book, they're trying to solve mysteries and understand each other, which they didn't do so well in life. So I was happy about that in these separate incidents, these ghost stories, the mother comes back and they have a setting where they can sit and talk to each other. But so what's the difference between fiction and nonfiction? I wrote a book about a whole group of women, well-known women, who formed a community. It's called The Telling. And these were actual women, like Gloria Steinem and Letty Pogrebin, and I had to, and Grace Paley. And so although they were already characters, I had to give them more character, or I had to give them my own sense of their character. I had to interpret their character. So even though it was nonfiction, I was using the techniques of fiction to flesh them out.
And would you feel that with this book, with The Red Squad, that the telling of the story in a fictional way gives you more freedom, perhaps? You know, and also what it, I guess it allows you to be more critical in a way of the characters, because you can demonstrate their falling, you know, their failings, maybe in a way that's more indirect.
That's very interesting. The danger of writing, or not the danger of having a strong political stance, is that you become very hortatory.
Right.
You nudge your reader. And I want to do it because the character had very strong feelings. But I thought if it were done at second or third hand, not that I believe, but that look what happened to her, and she believes because of her ancestry, as the reader wouldn't put up their hand and say, halt. They'd say, oh, well, that's what she's doing. And that distance, it seems to me, makes it more accessible.
Right. No, I think that's right. I actually also thought that you had you know, in this book, a great sense of humor. You know, that there's a warmth and lovingness about the book that comes. You know, you obviously love these characters, I think, in some way. And
I love being a teacher. I love teaching, so it shows.
And I noticed at the beginning, this is sort of a structural thing. You gave a cast of characters. And I thought, you know, I kind of went through that, and then when I went back to look at the book again, I thought, well, this actually seems almost like setting up a play, that, you know, you could see the Red Squad story as very much a set of, you know, in a, you know, the French farce scenes,
yes.
So, you know, where the doors open, doors close, characters come on, characters go away. It almost, I started to think of it as you'd written it almost as a... not as a play per se, but it has elements of that kind of dramatic technique.
Well, you know, I've done that with other. I had a novel called A Wave of Women, and I have a big embrace in characters. I maybe too many, but I always have a lot of characters, and so just so people don't go nuts, I have to do that.
Right. Well, no, it is actually confusing at times trying to remember who is who and,
yes.
you know, what their roles are. And because
yes.
you're going back and forth between time periods and also mm-hmm. talking about what's happened in between in some cases, you're right. I think the, it's good to have a list of a kind of cheat sheet to go back to remember who everybody is because there's a lot of activity and, you know, you're covering a lot. I mean, this is not a long book, and you're covering 40 years of a lot of people's lives.
Yes, but not the in between, sort of the beginnings and the middle ages.
Right, you get to sort of infer
yeah.
a lot of the middle history between 1969 and the present. Well, and I guess, you know, it's hard not to ask. You spent time in Detroit when you taught...
I beg your pardon? I didn't hear you.
Well, you spent time in Detroit when you were teaching at Wayne State.
Yes.
And this book takes place in Detroit. And there's a really good, I mean, a strong sense of place, you know, recognizing that...
Oh,
that,
good.
You know, you feel the Detroit of that era, I think, pretty strongly through the book.
Oh, good.
But, you know, I guess that it's sort of, you can't help but ask the question, is this really autobiographical in either directly or indirectly in some way?
You know, is information autobiographical, David? That's an interesting question. When you take information and put it out of people's mouths, I mean, you're for it or against it, but information is neutral, right? A lot of the book dealt with information. And a misuse of information. So and the character is trying to clarify what's happening. She doesn't begin a total cynic, but as things add up, she becomes skeptical of governmental
right.
pronouncements.
Well, that's true. She becomes actually the more she knows, the more she has to doubt.
Now, is it autobiographical? Well, I am a college teacher. I teach creative writing. I lived in Detroit. Unlike Anka, I've been long married and have many children.
Right, and you're not Greek.
So. I'm not Greek. How did you know?
Somehow I knew. But no, I didn't. I don't think of it as, you know, being a thinly veiled autobiography at all. But There must be elements of it that are big.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. Of course, you know, all college professors have been instructors. And what happens in innocence? What happens? I mean, in actuality, there was a drug raid. In actuality, the police department did plant marijuana in a house, a gathering place. That was quite a strong case. And these were my young friends who were not tenured, new to the department. That was a shocking thing to the soul to see injustice. Right out, to see police lying who would think, you know, they're supposed to help you across traffic.
Right. No, it is actually, I think that the thing that happened in the 60s and that I think could be valuable for people today to realize is that the structures, institutions that people believed were taking care of them turned out to not quite be so.
Yes.
And I think that's actually valuable information for people today to question authority, to question the ideas that people state to them as truth. You know, I think the lesson that you teach here is that things are not always as they appear to be, and that you really have to look inside yourself to see what is right and what is true.
Yes. Well, I had the advantage of having a newspaper man father, a darling, wonderful, moral man who would teach me intellectual curiosity and also say, you can't believe everything you read.
Right. Well, that's actually very important today, because when we go online and we read on the web constantly information that's, you know, we think it might be true, but it's not given any provenance. We don't know where it comes from.
Right.
So it is impossible to know. And that can be both good and bad. It can be voices that we get to hear that were disempowered before telling us their truths. But it could also be propaganda.
Yes. You're right.
It's the
but not everybody has that. He taught me how to type when I was 4 years old. I mean, isn't it marvelous to have that advantage of being a cynical four-year-old?
Well, I can imagine that, actually. A cynical four-year-old is a great image. But what does that mean when you're... does that mean you retain... Do you retain that sense of doubt? You know, are you a healthy cynic now?
I'm a hurt cynic. It goes on too long. And how long can you not believe? My natural nature is to embrace and loving. And so it goes against my nature to question all the time. But on the other hand, I mean, you become a teacher because you're interested in research and in truth. And that has to be who you are in life.
Well, you've done a beautiful job with this book. I really enjoyed it, and I hope that you know, that other people will feel the same way.
Well, thank you. I'm so happy about that.
No, it was a really, and it also, you made it fun. It's you know, I think the book has a sense of humor, and it has a wonderful flow that you know, because it isn't, in fact, expository at all. It's in, you know, it's a beautifully in, you know, a presented bunch of characters living through a long period of time, and I think you know, it's just, it was really wonderful.
Thank you. So, well, laughing is the most important thing to me.
Absolutely. Well, it keeps you sane. I guess it's the only thing you can do in the face of pain.
Yes.
And suffering is to laugh.
Yes.
So I really want to thank you for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you for calling me. I've enjoyed that so much, too.
Thanks. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host, and I've had the pleasure of a conversation with Esther Bronner, the author of The Red Squad. Thanks so much.